All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's seminar on Taiwan Strait 2018. My name is Russell Hsiao. I am the Executive Director of the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to Taiwan policy research and analysis. Our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing to a more informed public discussion about Taiwan here in the United States and around the world. Toward that end, we undertake several major programs that include a bi-weekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief that features timely analysis written by leading and emerging scholars focused on Taiwan. We also organize regular public seminars like the one that you are participating in today, addressing timely developments related to Taiwan so that we can raise awareness about these policy issues about Taiwan here in D.C. We also organize an annual symposium. We were actually in the process of planning our second annual symposium slated for September of this year. So stay tuned for more information about that. But that conference is going to be solely focused on U.S.-Taiwan relations, where we are and how do we move forward. We also offer fellowship opportunities for American scholars and researchers to go to Taiwan to conduct short-term fellowship research there. And we also offer short-term fellowships for Taiwanese scholars and activists to come to the United States for a short-term fellowship to conduct their research here in Washington, D.C. Last but not least, we also have an ongoing series of cultural programs. As a matter of fact, in conjunction with many institutes here at George Washington University, we will be holding our first ever art exhibit next week, next Thursday. So if you haven't already subscribed to receive all our updates where you get the latest information about our programs and opportunities, you may visit our website at www.globaltaiwan.org, and you should subscribe so that you can get all this information delivered to your inbox immediately and be the first to know among your friends about all these exciting programs and opportunities that we have available here today. So before I begin, I would just also acknowledge the continued support of our co-founders, our board of directors, our advisors, our staff, and of course our summer interns whom you've met as you were registering here for this event today. All these programs and events and publications would not be possible without their support. So, you know, on your way out, when you see them, please, encourage them, and hopefully you also stay tuned to see if you're interested for our future internship opportunities. So let's begin. So anyone who is paying attention to Taiwan will know that the country will have a potentially game-changing midterm election later this year, in November. The same is the case here for the United States, the results of which could have consequential effects on the 2020 presidential election and beyond. These events are also occurring within a strategic environment that is changing. There are a number of external factors shaping the context of relations across the Taiwan Strait in 2018, which should not be lost on observers. Since Beijing decided to freeze high-level dialogue with the Thai administration when it took office in May 2016, cross-strait relations between the two governments have been at a standstill. Yet, just last week, CCP Chairman Xi Jinping met with the former chairman of the Nationalist Party and the vice president of Taiwan, Lian Zhan, in Beijing, and sounded what some analysts have described as a moderate tone. In the meeting, she, and I quote, stated that as long as the coordinates are correctly set in history, the ship carrying the hope of a peaceful cross-strait unification will eventually sail to the side of victory, end quote. The statement stands in stark contrast to Xi's more hardline speech that he gave back in March at the National People's Congress, where he asserted, quote, "The Chinese people and nation share a common belief that every inch of our great motherland's territory cannot and is impossible to be separated from China," end quote. At the same time, the PLA has continued to significantly ramp up military exercises around Taiwan and engaged in coercive behaviors aimed at pressuring Taiwan's government into submitting to Beijing's demands for cross-strait negotiations. Even as we speak, a major live-fire exercise is underway in the East China Sea. These intensifying activities, which involve 10 elements that are quickly outlined, include 1, poaching diplomatic allies, 2, military coercion, 3, economic coercion, 4, excluding and marginalizing Taiwan within international organizations, 5, applying pressure on multinational corporations, 6, downgrading non-diplomatic partners of non-diplomatic relationship partnerships of Taiwan, 7, economic incentives to create pressure points within Taiwanese society, 8, political warfare such as through United Front, 9, cyber activities, and 10, espionage. And despite all this pressure, the Thai administration has repeatedly stated that it will stand its ground. And at the same time, it has repeatedly called for talks with Beijing while extending its economic and people-to-people outreach through its new southbound policy. Just yesterday, the Minister of Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council spoke at a conference in Washington, D.C., and reiterated the foundation of the Thai administration's cross-strait policy as continuing to be based on the ROC Constitution, the Act governing relations between the people of the Taiwan area and the mainland area, as well as other relevant legislation, and the historical fact of the 1992 meetings. Minister Chen called on Beijing to resume high-level talks with Taiwan without political preconditions, stating, quote, "We are willing to promote cross-strait dialogue and communication in any form, at any place, without political preconditions." The United States is not an idle player in the region. At the same conference where the MAC minister spoke, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia and Pacific Security Affairs, Brandy Shriver, described Taiwan as a valuable partner promoting a free and open Indo-Pacific, and suggested how U.S. policy towards China is now being guided by objective reality, in which China is a strategic competitor of the United States, as is clearly spelled out in the Trump administration's national security strategy. And he offers support for what he described as the Thai administration's important principal position in maintaining the status quo. In light of all these developments and more, what are the prospects for cross-strait relations for the rest of 2018 and beyond? And what are the implications for U.S.-Taiwan relations? I'm very pleased today to be joined by such an esteemed panel of experts from D.C. and from Taiwan. It is rare that we have so many expertise from Taiwan here in Washington, D.C., and we are very delighted to be hosting them here for this public seminar. To my immediate left, we have Dr. Kenny Chen, who is the Vice President of the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. Her work responsibility at the foundation involved overseeing international affairs and general administrative organization at TFD. Dr. Chen is a political scientist by training and received her doctoral degree in political science from the University of Oklahoma, specializing in comparative politics, democratization, international relations, and political philosophy. To her left, we have Tiffany Ma, who is a senior director at Bauer Group Asia, where she manages BGA's client relationship engagements. She directs analysis and activities designed to advise Fortune 500 companies on public policy issues, regional geopolitics, and stakeholder management. Prior to joining BGA, Tiffany was a senior director for political and security affairs at the National Bureau of Asian Research in Washington, D.C. To her left, we have Dr. Yizhong Lai, who is the president of the Prospect Foundation and the executive director of the International Affairs Committee of the Taizong City Government. Dr. Lai served as Director General for the Department of International Affairs and Director General of the Department of China Affairs in the now ruling Democratic Progressive Party. Prior to that, he was a Special Assistant for Policy to Taiwan's representative to Japan and Executive Director for DDP Mission in the United States and Vice President of the Taiwan Think Tank. To his left, we have Dr. Zheng Yi Lin, who is the President of the Institute for National Defense and Security Research in Taiwan. Prior to this position, he was the first deputy minister at the Mainland Affairs Council in the Executive Yuan. From 2004 to 2005, Dr. Lin was the director of the Institute for International Relations at the National Zhenzhou University, and he's held numerous government posts to include serving as senior advisor at the National Security Council in Taiwan. Last but not least, we have Dr. Roger Cliff, who is a senior research scientist at CNA. He has over 20 years of experience analyzing security and defense issues in East Asia at CNA, the Atlantic Council, the Project 2049 Institute, RAND Corporation, and the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Particular areas of expertise include China's strategy and doctrine, China's military capabilities, China's aerospace and defense industries, and U.S. strategy and policy towards the Asia-Pacific region. So as you can all see, we have a wealth of expertise on the panel today. And so rather than going through my normal format of asking each of these individuals questions, I'm going to have our speakers actually present on specific topics that they have that they are specialized in. And afterwards, I'll initiate a moderated discussion followed by audience Q&A. Dr. Chen, would you please kick us off?
Okay. Thank you.
Bring that a little closer.
Thank you, Russell. Can you guys hear me? Okay. Thank you, Russell, for having us at GTI, and I am very happy and honored to be one of the panelists to talk about Taiwan in 2018. Since we were talking about, when we were discussing what we want to talk about today, Russell mentioned talking about cross-border relations, Taiwan's relations with China, and high politics issues, such as the things that Russell just mentioned. I thought that when I was thinking about what I want to talk about, I thought that it would be good for me to address the audience on some of the domestic implications on China's involvement in Taiwan's domestic politics. And I think one of the issues that I want to mention in my talk is the involvement of China-backed or China-supporting organizations and members of the organized crime. So I am actually someone who studies comparative democratization, and I research on democracy in the Asia-Pacific region. And specifically, I conduct research on Taiwan. Well, recently, I conducted research on Taiwan's social movement as it reflects Taiwan's democratic quality. So I wrote a few chapters on social movement and people's way to gather and protest on specific issues relating to Taiwan's democratic values, such as people's rights to residence, government's ability to take away people's land or expropriate their land or evict them for the purpose of economic or social prosperity. So I have been tracking social movement on various issues relating to democratic values for the past the last few years. And what I want to tell you guys is that I see a change in Taiwan's social movement and those who participate in advocating for their rights in the past 2 years. What I observe is that there is, since the Tsai Ing-wen administration took administrative power, there's still a series of social movement regarding, let's say, government's proposed reforms, such as the pension reform, labor law reform, and issues as such. But what I observe is that there is a increased behavior or violent behavior amongst the protesters. And I think prior to that, people who study Taiwan social movement or journalists who write about Taiwan social movement, they came upon a very interesting characteristic of protest in Taiwan. And I don't think that people around the world have ever seen anything like this, is that Taiwanese protesters are extremely not only do they adopt a nonviolent way of holding hands and sitting in or lying on the ground holding arms together to prevent government expropriation of people's houses, they're also very orderly. One of the I recall one of the protests in front of the executive yuan that I observed. These are members of a particular borough in Miaoli County, and they were there to protest the installation of wind turbines near their farmland, because they were saying that because what they feel is that the humming, constant humming voice noises of the wind turbine is very really disturbing to their overall health and their crops and their animals. So they want to they really want to present an image of the atrocity that was done to their body. So they were using red paint to symbolize their blood. So what happened was that they pull the fake blood on one of the protesters. But before that, they actually had a like a tarp, like a plastic tarp under the protesters. So once they did what they did, and the media took photos of the protester, and they received press releases from the protesters, people from the borough actually brought buckets of water to clean the ground in front of the executive yuan. So after they were done, it's as if nothing has happened, just a bit of a wet spot. And it was really hot that day, so if you go by the executive yuan 10 minutes after, you would not even recognize what just took place. So these are some of the kind of protests that I observe. Even with the massive protests for our army officer Hong Zhongqiu, who was reportedly hazed, and he eventually passed away. There's about a quarter of a million people having a rally in front of the presidential office. But after the people left, after the rally, you see people picking up trash. And of course, after maybe 30 minutes, when people dispersed, the Kailagalan Boulevard was completely clean. And you see these kind of very... I see that the Taiwanese protesters and young people are very practical into... they are there to make a point, and they will sit and have very passionate speeches. And that's the extent of the social movement that I watch, of course, including the Sunflower Movement, that I observe in the past few years. But something had changed and shifted from 2 years ago. And you see, the first time that I observed this entity kind of emerge out of the social movement was on April 1st, 2014. I remember because it's April Fool's Day. So there's about 500 people led by a person named Zhang Anle, nicknamed the White Wolf, showing up in front of the legislative yuan in an attempt to try to extract protesters or the sunflower protesters from the legislative yuan. And what happened was that the local police did their job. Legislators and city council actually showed up standing in front of the White Wolf's he's a group of people. So eventually the White Wolf went away. So a little bit about Zhang Anle. He claims that he has no affiliation with organized crime now. That's what he said. But he was affiliated with the Bamboo Union, one of the three major organized crime or gangs in Taiwan. And he returned to Taiwan in 2013, I think, from China after staying back there for quite a few years. And he was also imprisoned in the United States for his affiliation with organized crime as well. So after Mr. Zhang came back to Taiwan, he established the China Unification Promotion Party. As you know, Taiwan is a vibrant democracy. There's no one stopping Mr. Zhang from organizing or forming his political party. But ever since then, There's activities from the what we call CUPP individuals at different protests. And the way to identify them is that they actually wear jackets that identify themselves as members of CUPP, and they have their pro-unification flags. So it wasn't difficult to tell who is what at these protests, pension reform protests, labor law protests. And there is also, I would observe an increased pushing and shoving, I would say physical altercation with police officers. And one of the most recent protests on pension reform, I would say, in my own opinion, that I saw one of the most violent and unusual behavior by the protesters. And what I thought that it was unusual by the protesters was because what I just told you about what social movement was like prior to 2 years. There are people who have chains, and a lot of people who are unidentified, and they wear facial masks, so police couldn't identify them. And what else? And I think one of the more serious moments were when the MC of the protest identified different district police chiefs who are trying to maintain order in front of the legislative yuan, and trying to cultivate the protesters to actually snatch the police chiefs and kick them off the premise. So there were quite a few police chiefs with their shirts ripped, and they were thrown out of the protest venue. And another thing that I thought that was I have not seen was the roughing up and attack of journalists. And people would tell me, you would have thought that there's, if you know Taiwanese media, there's vast companies of newspapers, but they have different political affiliation, or they identify with different political camps. But in that particular protest, all journalists representing all newspapers were attacked. Once they see the journalists with the badge identify themselves as journalists, the badge was taken away, their cameras ripped from their faces, and their pens ripped away. So I've been observing these kind of social movement behavior for the past 2 years, and it concerns me because of the attempt of the Unification Promotion Party making itself as a usual entity inside of Taiwanese politics, because they're an actually registered political party. But then the things that they were involved in, the rallies that they cultivate, speaks a tone that is coherent with that of China and the Chinese authoritarian rhetoric, and to tarnish Taiwan's democratic procedures and values. So these are some of the things that that I observed in the past 2 years. And because this year is Taiwan's local election year, you will see more rallies, more rhetoric that permeates Taiwan's society. So I think this is one of the factors that I want to mention to you guys today. And if you have any other questions, you could ask me later. But the involvement of pro-unification parties and organized crime is something that I think within Taiwanese politics that people need to pay a lot more attention to.
Thanks so much for that, Kenny. And you know, it's an important reminder, especially with your observation, as we here in the United States grapple with questions of meddling of the 2016 elections, that we also, and increasingly now, concerns over Chinese or CCP influence operations in the United States, that here's a case study where Taiwan is at the forefront of CCP political warfare. And I think there's a lot of lessons that we could draw from Taiwan's experience. And so thank you so much for sharing that firsthand observation. Tiffany?
Great. Thank you, Russell. And I just want to begin by thanking the Global Taiwan Institute for having me. It really is a great privilege to be part of such an esteemed panel. So I've been asked to address the political and economic dimensions of cross-strait relations in 2018. And what I want to do is start by highlighting two trends that we've observed in 2018 so far, and then sort of talk about the outlook for the remainder of the year and beyond. So the first trend I want to address, and just picking up on where Russell left off in his introduction, is that there is currently a contrast, a very vivid contrast, between the ongoing economic exchanges and the very much frozen official political dialogue. So today, cross-strait economic integration is moving ahead. There is very much complementarity between the markets and resources on both sides. And we see now that China is the largest destination for Taiwan's exports. Taiwan has obviously brought very significant investments into China. And Taiwan was China's seventh largest trading partner in 2017. And we see that the trade between the two sides has actually grown since the DPP took office, increasing 14% year on year between 2016 and 2017. And obviously, the deals under the Ma government are still ongoing, the 23 agreements and so on and so forth under the detente. So we see that business people and investors are still seeing reason to continue ongoing economic relations. But this is very much in contrast to the political space. As mentioned, high-level political dialogues have been frozen, and this is very much due to this disagreement over the 1992 consensus. Despite President Tsai's pledge to maintain the status quo and her acknowledgement of the fact the 1992 meeting actually took place, this has been very much insufficient for Beijing. And this is very clearly evident in Beijing's preference of continuing to engage with the opposition KMT party. As Russell mentioned earlier this month, the former KMT chairman Lian Chan was in Beijing for official meetings with Xi Jinping, and that's made possible because the KMT maintains their own interpretation of what was agreed to in 1992. So they ascribe to one China, but with different interpretations. So despite Tsai's management, relatively stable management of cross-strait relations, we've seen the political situation evolve into kind of a stalemate or cold peace, where we have economic relations in the absence of political, high-level political engagement. And not only are political relations frozen at the high level, we're also seeing, as Russell mentioned, that China has increased coercive pressures against Taiwan to further isolate Taiwan from the international community, but also to undermine its legitimacy as Beijing seeks to work towards its ultimate goal, which is unification. So this very much defines the second trend in cross-strait relations that we've seen this year. And that's very much Beijing's use of sharpening hard power and, I think, a more resolute use of its soft power as well. And I'm just going to focus on how this is playing out in the political and economic space and leave other colleagues to address how this is playing out in the military and security space. So in the political space, we're seeing increasing isolation of Taiwan, the fact that Taiwan was not able to participate in the WHA, and its reporters were also banned from participating as well, and it was not able to participate in the International Civil Aviation Organization meeting as well. Taiwan is also facing increasing diplomatic isolation as Panama, Sao Tome and Principe, and also in this year specifically, we've seen the Dominican Republic and Burkina Faso switching their diplomatic recognition to Beijing, which is part of Beijing's campaign to further put pressure on Taiwan, and leaving Taiwan now with 18 diplomatic allies. And we've also seen unprecedented measures. So the M503 flight path was implemented unilaterally without consultation with Taipei, and this actually creates some concern about the safety of civil aviation in the Taiwan Strait. Another emerging trend that we're seeing is the increasing politicization of companies and how they talk about Taiwan on their website and how Taiwan is listed. So, for example, we've seen this with Marriott, with the various airlines that are being pressured to categorize Taiwan as a province of China. And really, indeed, there's no target too small for Beijing right now in terms of getting their way in how Taiwan is talked about. I want to flag one example in Australia, where I'm from, where there's currently a lot of discourse about Chinese influence campaigns on campuses and the political system. But there's in Queensland, there's a small town called Rockhampton, and there was a group of students who painted this art project, and one of which is a Taiwan flag among many on this art project. And it was actually painted over because it displayed the Taiwan flag, and that was displeasing to people who support Beijing's One China principle. So we've seen a push towards Beijing's preferred nomenclature about Taiwan, both at the very high levels politically, horizontally, expanding in the economic space, and also at the lower level to things like a children's art project in a small town in Australia. So on the political side, we're seeing the increasing coercion. I do want to highlight that on the economic side, the story is a little bit different, and this is where Beijing's been pushing a little bit more of its softer approach, trying to build towards greater economic integration. So we're talking about trade. We're seeing trade being talked about rather in somewhat more cooperative terms. So, for example, at the Boao Forum in April, Xi Jinping declared that the PRC would like to share developmental opportunities with the people of Taiwan, and he also interestingly praised Taiwanese companies for contributing to China's development. In March, we saw that Beijing unveiled a package of 31 measures, which ostensibly made it easier for Taiwanese people and companies to work and study on the mainland. This has created a little bit of structural concerns about whether this is going to create more of a hollowing out of industry in Taiwan, whether it's going to create a brain drain situation by encouraging the most talented people in Taiwan to go work in China. And of course, there are political concerns about, does this increase Taiwan's dependency on the PRC as well? And these concerns are certainly not unfounded. Economic relations, at least from Beijing's perspective, do serve a political purpose for paving the path towards what they see as eventual unification. So it is maybe no surprise to see that economic relations have been continuing while the political situations have been frozen, because Beijing does very much see economic integration as in support of its ultimate political agenda. And that's really reinforced by the economic coercion that we've seen the cross-strait, at least the direct cross-strait trade, kind of being talked about in a more cooperative sense. But this is also in contrast with Taiwan's economic policy intersects with its international space. So we're seeing that while Beijing is supportive of ongoing cross-strait trade, it is using Taiwan's international space, at least in Taiwan's international economic space, as a way of coercing Taiwan. So in the frozen political context, we're seeing that China is likely going to oppose Taiwan's efforts to expand FTAs and be part of regional economic arrangements that exclude China. And China's Belt and Road Initiative, which expands into Southeast Asia and South Asia, it's unclear on how that's going to interplay with Taiwan's new southbound policy. So what we're seeing right now is frozen politics, warm economics, and very much heat of pressure from Beijing. So it's very clear that the status quo in the cross-strait situation is changing. So where does that really leave us for the rest of 2018 and beyond? And while we see that Taiwan has some very clear vulnerabilities, I think another part of the story about 2018 is that Taiwan is developing greater resilience, at least in some aspects of the economic and political space. So in the economic space, we're seeing Taiwan moving forward to diversify its trade partners away from China, and that's very much captured in President Tsai's flagship New Southbound policy. And it's important to note that the New Southbound policy is about more than just economics. It focuses very heavily on cultural and people-to-people exchanges, and we're seeing that already reaping benefit in terms of the increasing tourist inflow from Southeast Asia. And I think this is why also that countries in Southeast Asia and South Asia will find benefit in terms of engaging with Taiwan under the new southbound, in addition to how they might choose to engage with China under the Belt and Road, because the public narrative of these two initiatives are quite different. While the Belt and Road focuses very heavily on infrastructure, for example, I think President Tsai's initiative focuses more on a lot of the cultural and people-to-people exchanges which benefit the Southeast Asian and South Asian nations. We've seen that Taipei has unveiled its own countermeasure to the 31 measures from Beijing, and that's under the Four Directions and Eight Strategies initiative of the government. And on the political side, we're seeing greater resilience in terms of the strengthening unofficial political relationship that Taiwan has. So one example, of course, is Japan, where following the changing of the names of the representative offices, we've seen very fruitful initiatives such as the Fourth Summit on Taiwan-Japan Exchange, which took place earlier this month, and we're seeing Taiwan and Japan agreeing to cooperation on responding to chemical disasters, actually, so very much in the humanitarian assistance and disaster space, which I think Taiwan is a regional leader in. And most importantly, the unofficial relationship with the United States, I think here is a major resiliency factor for Taiwan. And this is due to both, I think at the same time there is a changing view of China, which was alluded to earlier, but also a growing support for Taiwan, especially within Congress. And, you know, this is in response to what U.S. policymakers have seen as Beijing's increasing pressure on Taiwan that's leading to a slight recalibration in Washington. So in closing, of course, there is certainly more that China can do to pressure Taiwan in the remainder of 2018 and beyond. But I think the resiliency factor, both in the economic and political space, are new developments within this year and are key factors to shaping the outlook for the rest of 2018 and beyond. And with that, I will leave it there, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Tiffany, for that very insightful presentation. And I think you make an excellent and very important point, and that is while our focus has been, you know, overwhelmingly on the sort of the political stalemate, the cold peace, that, you know, economic exchanges and economic ties between Taiwan and China continues to grow. And while I think we've traditionally viewed these as two separate tracks, the political and economic, I would argue that they are increasingly converging. And I think we always knew that China sort of saw that converging. Greater economic integration means greater political integration. And I think there's an added layer of risk now that on one hand, there is Taiwan being concerned about, of course, its industry being hollowed out by moving overwhelmingly into the China market, but the other side of it, of course, is the question becomes, is in this looming U.S.-China trade war, how is Taiwan going to get, might Taiwan get caught up in this? Because, of course, a lot of the manufacturing in China are owned, high-tech, are owned by Taiwan businesses. So thank you for that. It's a very important reminder. Dr. Lai? Please.
Yeah, thank you. Just follow up on the two previous excellent presentations. I think when we look at the year 2018 and beyond, one of the critical events that we discover is that the in terms of U.S.-China relations, year 2017 December, the National Security Strategy, which basically laid out the fundamental different approach toward China. And if you look at the, despite whatever people has an opinion about the Trump as a president, but the Trump administration itself seems to be very much consistent in terms of its dealing in Asia Pacific, especially toward China. And there's a joke when we talk with the Chinese scholars, what they said is that they counted the praise of the President Trump toward the foreign leaders in China. The Xi Jinping is apparently way on the number one, like two or three times more than the Abe from Japan and others. But look at the current U.S.-China relations. It seems that the more the President Trump praised Xi Jinping, the harder the U.S.-China relations is going to get. So, of course, it creates a great deal of the confusion, not only for the U.S. ally, but particularly also for China, because they just cannot get sense of how come the president among themselves, they have so much of the good personal chemistry, but the overall relationship can turn out this the poison at this moment. So in going back to these things, basically when we discover the national security strategy that's laid out and all the later on the deployment or the implementations, whether from the national defense strategies that came out or the Alex Wong, his speech, whether that's in Taiwan or in the United States about Indo-Pacific strategy, also about the James Mattis, his speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue, we found out the very consistent approach toward China about how the U.S. would see China. But I think it is important to know that the it's not just about strategy and also implementation, but it is a messaging that by those strategy came out that started to ring out for a country, including Taiwan, that what the U.S. The future direction will be. And so that there's a definite effect about how that will imply and what Taiwan needs to readjust its relations or its foreign policy directions in this regard. And so, and for example, in terms of the U.S.-China trade war, and definitely there is a the discussion within the Taiwan's government and also in the government experts about how the domestic economic agendas, directions, the structure, as we see that as this trade war will go on, as because it's a structural issue, and also the Taiwan's readjustment, how that will fit into this in order to cope with this direction. So basically, I would say that the documents and also the several of the strategies are laid out. Despite what people, personal opinion about President Trump, but he started to lay out what the future direction should be and the requirement for Taiwan to adjust to these new changes. And also it is important to know that when we talk about the economy, people tended to look at the economic the so-called achievement of economy in terms of the big trade agreements, so the TPP or the U.S.-Taiwan FTA or whatever. But I think right now the biggest changes within Taiwan in terms of economic thinking is actually on the more detailed secretarial dependence that's on China and how to readjust on that, and also in terms of the how to harvest the new industrial development, taking on the new technology that associated with it, and more emphasis on the indigenous innovations. Of course, the new southbound policies also falls into directly into this wider context of the how the Taiwan's future economic plan should be. So I think right now probably what we discover or we saw is that the more emphasis is actually on the different sectors of the economy rather than on the big trade agreements that has been in the discussions. And to a certain extent, I think this is a healthy because we can actually go to the more details and really examine what was really there, what is really there, and to cope with the new changes. And so that this and also there's another development that's very clear signal to Taiwan, that is how the U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy include Taiwan and Taiwan's position in it. And so there are numerous occasions where the U.S. found out that how the Taiwan's new southbound policy is compatible with the new U.S. Indo-Pacific strategies. And so that right now all the discussions focus on how the Taiwan can propose or Taiwan's vision about its southbound policy and how that fit into the Indo-Pacific strategy. And the discussion has been going on in various areas. And what Tiffany Ma earlier mentioned about the Taiwan-China relations, especially in terms of the economy, when she said something about the trade between Taiwan and China is actually increased. But I think if you look at this combined with another figure, that is the investment. Taiwan's investments to China, the growth rate is actually reduced. So we have the decrease of the investment growth. Despite that, we have the increase in terms of the trade. So that what does that mean? So that gave us a more complicated the Taiwan, China, and probably with other countries the economic interdependence the pictures. And it's also important to know that All those happens because those numbers are like year 2016, year 2017, and we haven't had the number in 2018 yet. But so those numbers came out before the 31 measures came out. So that the issue was that is that despite the Chinese so-called the pressure, including economy on Taiwan, the trade actually the China still import more from Taiwan. So what does that mean that the in the local localities in China and the people who are actually doing the business, they have their own way or a different way of managing this. So that also begs us to think twice about what the real picture in Taiwan-China economy, the relationship. Tiffany Ma also mentioned about the 31 measures and how the Taiwan is fearful about the brain drain. But I think if you look at the 31 measures related with the so-called China wanted to attract youth, I think if you go back to the Chinese measure on Taiwan about 5 years ago during the Hu Jintao era, China was talking about how to get into the island, get into the people, get into their hearts, and they throw resources into Taiwan. But then when Xi Jinping came in year 2013, started to talk about how Taiwan should join China in helping China develop so that the Taiwanese people could enjoy the whole Chinese great achievement. And so the direction, the resources thrown, the direction is completely different. The Hu Jintao era is the resources thrown into Taiwan. But Xi Jinping is talking about that Taiwan should throw resources into China. So so for a great nation like this, they are actually asking Taiwan, as portrayed by them as a poor nation, poor economic development, performance nation. But they ask Taiwan to throw resources into China to help them to develop so that Taiwanese people can enjoy the great achievements. I think that's sort of the reverse logic that is at play here. But I would say it's just a clever Chinese advertisement about what Taiwan should do. Another thing about those sort of measure in terms of the so-called brain drain, we also have numerous examples. One of them just happened to one of my close friends personally. He has been teaching in China for about 10 years. And then just one click, and the school asked him, "You no longer belong here, so just pack it up and go back home." That's it. And we do see a lot of examples, not as dramatic like those, but it is like after one or two years, when the money the locality are gaining from the central government about the measures toward Taiwan has been run out, and no longer those things will apply to Taiwan, and those people has to nowhere to go but go back to Taiwan. And the example I do has been numerous. So I will say that right now, even though the 31 measures published by Side China, as this is the one of the very important and very powerful vehicle that Taiwan basically will just join in the greater Chinese families. But I think it probably will play out. This is my own view. It probably will play out like the One Belt One Road after 3 or 4 years. We do know that the year 2013 onward, how the One Belt One Road, that project had been publicized as one of the great Chinese influence in the whole world. But then it is until the last year and this year we started to see a lot of the local resistance and the dissentment against this one, and how some of the project that's not really fulfilled the need and created the kind of animosities. So I think, well, we have set probably 1 or 2 or 3 years, we can see what actually come out. And, of course, the military pressure on Taiwan, that has been increased, especially after the 19th National Congress, that in the past probably it was 1 or 2 aircraft circling around Taiwan, but then later on it has been in a bigger part of formation, the fighter jets, the bombers, the reconnaissance flight, the plane, they come in probably in 10, 15, even 20s and do a different route. If you look at some of those developments, you also tell us the kind of capability that the Chinese have, including what they so-called their stealth. It's not stealth, we know, because we discover. And also, in the past, that when the Chinese flight, we saw that encircling Taiwan, they always have the ship prepositioned in some of their routes, which means what? Which means that probably they are, whether they are afraid of those plane will happen to them something, and then so they need to have the some of the backup asset there to respond to some of the emergencies. And their aircraft carriers, yes, they make a big political splash, but capabilities also discovered by us, not well. Just like sitting duck, but this is my own work, not from our ministry, our national defense. About those, of course, despite the Chinese military threat and all those international isolation campaign, the pushback from the United States and other countries also been very obvious. So this is another new development that in the past about Taiwan's anxiety about the United States, especially about its commitment to Taiwan. I think due to some of the measures by the United States and also the internal communications, Taiwan's confidence about U.S. has regained, and the reassurance has been there. And Tiffany Ma also talked about the southbound policy, and I just mentioned some of the examples. Last year at the USAN Forum, we do have the sitting officials, senior, the ministerial, vice ministerial levels people coming from the Indonesia, coming from Thailand, coming from the Philippines and other countries to Taiwan. And this is just one of the examples that actually from year 2016 onward, especially the announcement of new southbound policy, that the ministerial level and the vice ministerial levels visits between Taiwan and those countries, not just about new southbound cargo states, had been numerous. I'll say numerous, which means that in the 30 times, 40 times visits a year by those, and it is just not limited to the Southeast Asia or New South Wales target states. We also have the numerous visits from the European countries, also in the ministerial, vice ministerial level visits. Although in the United States, the minister's visit seems to be a big political clash, but to many of those, it just happened, just like regular. So if we look at Taiwan's international engagement, I'll say that first, the issue about the New Southbound policy, to a certain extent, it works in terms of improving Taiwan's communication with those countries, and also associate a necessary level of the ministerial visits in this. And another thing is that some of the Taiwan's economic measures, especially in terms of how the new technology emboldened reform through the issues like the robotics, automations, 3D printings, big data, data analytics, and all those enabled social enterprises that also bring a new momentum for the Taiwan's engage with other countries that they're interested in those. Finally, I would just say that the Taiwan's engagement with the Quad and also has been intensified extensively. I'm not going to name about the exact things, but I just leave it there. But and looking from now and onward, I'll say that the year 2019, I'll say that the election result of the year 2018 probably would not affect about our external engagement that much. It is probably the year 2019, the several of the regional, the election in this region. We do know that in India, Indonesia, they have the major elections, Australia as well, and Japan will have its senator elections next year in July. And those, that could have the more of the impact in terms of shaping the regional perception as well as the regional orders here. So I'll just stop. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Yitong, for that, for really broadening out our discussion there with your comments. And I think you really make a good point about, you know, that the complexity of the economic relationship, and that it is not a one-way street, you know, right? And And I thought that, you know, it's for those of us here in D.C., in the trenches of D.C., it's refreshing to get an outside perspective, a Taiwan perspective, especially on the U.S.-China relationship, the state of the U.S.-China relationship, and also the Indo-Pacific strategy. And I particularly liked how you were linking the new southbound policy with the Indo-Pacific strategy. And I would love to see one day, and please point me to if it's already there, but a Taiwan's vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific, because I think that would be very helpful to the discussion here about what this free and open Indo-Pacific means, because it's not just a U.S.-led initiative. It's Japan, it's Australia, it's India, it's also other countries in the region, not just the Quad, right?
Yeah.
So it'd be great to see if Taiwan has a vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific. Dr. Lin? Please.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do prepare the PowerPoint, but for the constraint all the time, I just sit here and share my thought from Beijing Taiwan policy. Beijing had two sets of Taiwan policy. One set for the KMT government, the other set for the DPP government. But in the past 2 years, even for Beijing's Taiwan policy toward the Tsai Ing-wen administration, I do observe some paradigm changed or is changing across the Taiwan Strait. For example, instead of going to Taiwan, Yi Zhong just mentioned Beijing has adopted a policy trying to attract more students, more people from Taiwan to go to China, to go to mainland China. So that is one of the major change. And the second one, the Beijing authority used to court in the favor of the KMT, but it changed into putting more focus on the younger generation of Taiwan student, senior high school graduate at the age of 18 years old up to the 30 years old. That is the major age range Beijing would like to see, would like to welcome them in mainland China. And the third change is that from the very beginning, Beijing is somewhat moderate in its military action surrounding the water in Taiwan, but since the latter half of 2017 has become more aggressive and more assertive. So from the water and airspace in the middle of the Taiwan Strait to the airspace and water to the east of Taiwan, that is a very dramatic modification of Beijing posture against Taiwan. And number four, more frustration among the Chinese leader or the Chinese ordinary people regarding its Taiwan policy. So more radical netizen, at least 700 million serving on the net, they come into the radar screen in Beijing Taiwan policy. So in that sense, the leader in Beijing is somewhat influenced by the netizen in the Chinese society. And then the next one, and from more political pressure on the Tsai Ing-wen administration into an intensified by or with military action powering up, as I just mentioned, in addition to diplomatic tie, to military maneuver in water surrounding Taiwan. And from
demand on foreign government, foreign official government, to more demand on non-governmental organization or non-governmental multinational corporation or international airline, Tiffany Ma just mentioned. So we could see altogether from the end of the 2016 up to the current one, Beijing is still waiting for the final response from the United Airlines and Delta or the United States. And then from prior notification on several cases, several hours right before the major event took place, to a surprise tactic, surprise Taiwan, as we have witnessed in the case of the announcement of the M503 Hyrule, the northbound in the middle of the Taiwan Strait, and also in the case of the Panama and Dominican Republic switching diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing. And then the Chinese money used to go to Taiwan under the table, but currently, it's especially after 31 incentive. I don't call it 31 majors, more than 31 majors. If you look into the follow-up of several provinces, so among those 31 incentive, you could see more institutionalized channel are there for the Taiwanese civic group organization to apply the sponsorship from mainland Chinese counterpart. And then the other paradigm shift or it changing is from division of labor in semiconductor industry, which implies Taiwan keep the upper hand or high end on the research and development or ICT line. And after the 31 incentive, the government in Beijing tried to reverse that trend. So try to encourage research and development or the IC industry to go to mainland China, to different cities, Shanghai or Chongqing. And then there are things remain unchanged. Policy remain unchanged. In Beijing's side, from the conversation between Xi Jinping and Lin Zhan, President Xi Jinping mentioned and emphasized the importance of peaceful development and peaceful unification between Taiwan and China. And that policy still is the guideline, still the key of Parliament guiding principle in Beijing policy. And then in Taipei's side, President Tsai Ing-wen still honor her commitment to maintain the status quo across the Taiwan Strait. And the third development unchanged is, I call it the 1992 divided consensus. Remain unchanged from the Commonwealth Journal opinion poll in different years to the Taiwan Public Opinion Foundation. They all point to the one direction. It's still divided consensus. And more people in Taiwan, they believe, dealing with the quad-trade relations, and the government in Taiwan should simply bypass the 1992 consensus instead of sticking to that controversial consensus. And there are some brighter record or number. For example, the bilateral trade volume increased even under the political stalemate between Taiwan and China. For example, in 2017, the volume of bilateral trade between Taiwan and China increased 18%. And in the first two quarters of this year, increase about 14 to 15%. And there are also brighter lakes, but always overlooked by commentator or newspaper. The annual gross GDP growth rate in 2017 reached the number of 2.8%. That number still increased in the first two quarters or this year. For example, the first one 3.4, the second quarter 3%. So in average, 3.2 annual growth rate. And when a president, like President Tsai Ing-wen, is unconventional DPP chairperson, unconventional politician, it's very difficult to maintain her commitment and not retaliate when you are under attack, not only from within, but also from without the island. So I could say her commitment, her position still not only welcome inside the DPP itself, but also oversee the whole government, except some government in Southeast Asia, Laos, or Cambodia, or Myanmar. But if you go to the European Union, United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, they simply they appreciate the self-restraint of President Tsai Ing-wen. And for Taiwan, quad trade relations and the U.S.-Taiwan relations are equally important for the security of the island. And that remains the same. So for President Tsai, not only for one term or two terms, it's not enough for the security of Taiwan. She's looking into more than 2 years remain in her first term, or even after another 4 years in her second term. She's looking into at least 10 years from today, from 2018 to 2028, since President Xi Jinping abolished the limitation of two-term presidency in Beijing in February this year. So Taiwan simply keep a policy of prudent and a policy of vigilant and adopt an overall assessment contingency planning in the longer term. So I will stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Janine. I mean, that was particularly insightful, especially given the fact that you were the vice chairman of the Mainland Affairs Council, which is the cabinet level agency in charge of cross-strait policy up until just this May. And so I think, you know, the points that you made about the bifurcated policy that Beijing's policy towards Taiwan, set for a KMT, and set for DPP, sort of creates this two different realities. And it really goes towards their ability to sort of divide and conquer, right? And it really just, I think, goes to show just how closely Taiwan is observing Beijing's actions, policies, any nuances in the statements, and then trying to adjust to Beijing's pressure campaign. So thank you very much for that. Roger?
Hi, and I am delighted to be here and talking to you all, but I apologize. I should start out with the standard disclaimer that what I'm about to say represents only my views and not those of the Center for Naval Analyses or any of its sponsors. Okay, I'm glad to have that out of the way. I was asked to talk about the military dimension of the cross-strait situation, and as I think a number of our speakers have already pointed out, there have been significant developments here over the past year, particularly since the end of the 19th Party Congress in China in fall of 2017. There's clearly been a ramping up of not just diplomatic and political pressure on Taiwan, but also military pressure. We're seeing that in the form of various exercises, the circumnavigations of Taiwan by Chinese bombers and so on. And so that raises the question of, how is the military balance across the Taiwan Straits as of today, and where is it going in the future? And I would say the answer is, as it usually is, it's a mixture of good and bad news. And so that I don't leave you in suspense, let me start with the bad news first. And I realize this may come as a shock. The military balance in the Taiwan Strait is steadily tilting toward China. Okay, and now that we have that out of the way, let's talk about the good news. The good news is, provided the United States comes to Taiwan's defense, China does not currently have the capability to take Taiwan by force, nor will it anytime soon. Now, we've had a lot of attention given to the buildup of China's air, naval, and missile forces in recent years, and maybe the biggest news item recently in that regard was the beginning of sea trials of China's first indigenously built aircraft carrier, which is expected to be officially delivered to the Chinese Navy by the end of this year. When that happens, China will have two operational aircraft carriers when you include the Russian-built carrier that is already operating. And additional aircraft carriers are believed to be on the way, if not already under construction. China's also received attention for the large destroyers it's launched recently, the first of which is also likely to enter service later this year. And China is now operating its first fifth-generation stealth fighters, although we just heard a moment ago about some questions about how stealthy they truly are. Nonetheless, they are regarded as comparable to the U.S. F-22 and F-35. Well, all this is very impressive, and in terms of hardware, at least, China's military capabilities certainly exceed those of Taiwan by itself, but China does have a long ways to go before it matches the military capabilities of the United States. So let's take a look at those ships first. China, as I said, by the end of the year, China is likely to have two operational aircraft carriers. And although these are large ships, each weighing more than 60,000 tons fully loaded, they actually have a fairly limited capacity for aircraft. Each of them can only operate about 24 fighter aircraft. By contrast, U.S. Nimitz-class carriers, which comprise most of what the U.S. Navy is operating today, except for the newly commissioned Gerald Ford, which is even larger. Each of the Nimitz-class carriers can operate about 60 fighter aircraft. So that means each of the U.S. carriers worth about 2.5 times one of China's carriers in terms of combat capability. There's always one U.S. aircraft carrier based in Japan, and there's usually another one tooling around somewhere in the Western Pacific at any given time. Similar story holds with those destroyers. The new destroyers China's building are indeed very impressive, but the United States already has 11 Aegis cruisers, which are comparable in capability in the Pacific Fleet alone. We already have 11 of those, and another 11 in the Atlantic Fleet. We also operate 27 modern destroyers in our Pacific Fleet, whereas the entire Chinese Navy currently has between 18 or 20 modern destroyers. And a similar story holds with aircraft. So China is now operating a handful of stealthy or semi-stealthy fifth-generation fighters. Well, the U.S. military, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps combined are now operating almost 400 fifth-generation stealth fighters, including the F-22 and the F-35. And in terms of what are still considered modern fourth-generation fighters, the U.S. Navy alone operates more fourth-generation fighters than the Chinese Navy and Air Force combined. And that's just the hardware. We haven't even started to talk about the more important but intangible dimensions, such as quality of personnel, training, organizational culture, and recent combat experience. So if certainly from an American perspective, and you know, and I'm one of the people who've written about the so-called anti-access measures that China could potentially employ to try to keep the U.S. at bay, at least in the early stages of a conflict with China. Nonetheless, the military balance still favors the United States, and that's not likely to change anytime soon. So that's the good news. But I do want to include some warnings, which is, first of all, just because the military balance favors the U.S., that doesn't mean that war with China is something that the United States would enter into lightly, nor does it mean that it would not be potentially devastating for Taiwan if Taiwan were to be part of that conflict. It also, make sure I'm not forgetting anything important, it also doesn't mean that China wouldn't be willing to use force against Taiwan under certain circumstances, even though we've been sitting here in the air-conditioned room in Washington might assess that the military balance clearly favors the U.S. I can think of at least four possible circumstances where the Chinese government might choose to use force against Taiwan. One is if those anti-access measures I referred to earlier, if Chinese decision makers felt that they would be able to keep the U.S. out of the conflict or at least delay its entry into the conflict for long enough that Taiwan's resistance if China were using force against Taiwan, if they were able to cause the collapse of Taiwanese resistance before the U.S. could effectively intervene, they might try it anyways. Another possibility is if decision makers in China felt that Taiwan lacked the will to resist and would quickly capitulate once the first missiles started to fly. A third is if Chinese decision makers thought that the United States would not come to Taiwan's defense. And then, unfortunately, there's a fourth possibility, which is even if none of those first three things held true, Chinese decision makers under certain circumstances might feel that domestic pressure and Professor Lin was just talking about those 700 million netizens in China. If the Chinese government felt that domestic pressure required them to use force against Taiwan, even if they expected it to fail. So what does this mean for Taiwan? Well, it means that Taiwan is not a passive actor in all this. Just because Taiwan, in most people's assessment today, it would be incapable of defeating an attack from mainland China all by itself, that doesn't mean what Taiwan does is irrelevant. In particular, as I said earlier, if China were to try to use the anti-access tactics that I referred to try to keep the United States out of the conflict initially, or at least keep the United States from being effective in the conflict initially, Taiwan needs to be able to hold out on its own long enough for the U.S. to be able to overcome those anti-access measures. Second, I talked about the possibility that Chinese decision makers might think that Taiwan lacks the will to resist. Well, the best way to communicate a lack of will to resist would be to continue to try to maintain the most robust possible defense capabilities as Taiwan could. So that's a second reason why Taiwan needs to continue to maintain a strong indigenous defense capability. Third, I think a couple of our speakers have already mentioned that sentiment in the U.S. Under the current administration seems to be shifting in a more favorable direction for Taiwan. But certainly under the previous administration, and this wasn't just coming from that administration, but voices throughout the U.S. national security establishment questioning Taiwan's commitment to its own defense and wondering why the U.S. should come to Taiwan's defense if Taiwan wasn't willing to do more to defend itself. I think that's still a concern. Taiwan does need to show to the United States that it is doing the most it can for its self-defense. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, there is always the chance that all of the above, notwithstanding, Chinese decision makers, due to a combination of external and internal circumstances, feel like they have no choice but to engage in some sort of use of force against Taiwan. In those circumstances, how well Taiwan is prepared for that day will have a very important effect on what the consequences are. I'd love to talk more about individual weapon systems and training regimes and all that good stuff, but we are just about out of time, so I will stop here and hand it back to Russell.
That's wonderful, Roger, and thank you for that sober assessment from a lot of the sensational news coverage that we often hear and read about Taiwan's defense, and I'm glad you left us with some good news, because otherwise I feel like it's always bad news, right? When we hear about Taiwan's defense, and so thank you very much for that. You know, as Roger said, we are almost out of time, but I'd like to extend it for a little bit so that we can accommodate some questions from the audience. So if you can just raise your hand, wait for the mic. State your name and affiliation, and please keep it to a question if you can. Okay, all right. So, lady in the front, and let's take it in a group. We'll take it in a group and address this one.
Thank you. I have two questions. First, I wonder whether can help me to clarify one thing. You mentioned that military violence across the Taiwan Strait has shifted in favor of China, but the military balance between U.S. and China still favors U.S. Right? And the second question is, you also mentioned that if Chinese decision makers decide that the United States is not going to come to help Taiwan, so they might try to use force on Taiwan. So my question is for my Taiwan friends, do you think the United States has done enough to help Taiwan? Thank you.
This gentleman in the front over here. Over here. Great suit.
I have a question about COPD. Do you have any idea how many of them are students that did how? And then the question is, have you ever any found
any you
sign?
Repeat that?
How many members do they have? The first question. Second question is, have you ever found any kind of sign
that
you can down
to
China
and
supporting
them.
Okay, and I believe
this gentleman. Yeah. Hi, my name is Bill Kaver. I'm a freelance journalist. If someone on the panel could talk a bit about the local elections this year and what various outcomes might have in terms of affecting cross-strait policies. Let's say if there's an overwhelming DPP victory, do you think that there would be any change in the willingness to unfreeze relations on the part of Beijing?
Okay, let's stop it there, and then we'll, if we have enough time, we'll take another set. So we have the questions about the military balance, the CUPP, and the local elections.
Let me do the military balance one quickly. I apologize because I was trying to be dramatic. I kind of may have muddied the issue. My point is that military balance still favors the U.S. However, the trend line is certainly pointing in China's favor. So over time, the military balance will favor the U.S. less and less. But when I would say we are still years away from a point at which China actually has the military advantage in the Taiwan Strait. So the U.S. advantage is eroding, but it still holds the advantage for now.
Question about the CUPP and the local election?
I won't comment on the local election. I'm not very good at predicting the outcome. But but addressing your question about the CUPP, the CUPP claims itself claims that they have about 30,000 members, but that's according to the political party. But when it comes to party registrations and numbers, I don't personally have an accurate number of how many people the party actually recruits. But I think that the funding sources of political parties, I believe that Taiwanese legislature passed legislation regarding foreign funding of political parties, and it's not allowed. So that was what happened. Foreign funding of political parties is prohibited. But at the same time, there's other ways to funnel money inside of a country if an authoritarian regime wants to subvert its democratic system. But at the same time, I don't have evidence of that. But then at the the Taiwanese government, President Tsai has announced that there's going to be investigation because she takes subverting Taiwan's democratic system very seriously. So that's pretty much what I could tell you for the time being. And one thing that I want to mention is that in 2016, Global Times from China published a rhetoric on Lebanization of Taiwan, which is inherently creating chaos within Taiwan's democratic system, in terms to demonstrate to Taiwanese people that democratic system is inherently chaotic. And then with the publication, that's 2 years ago, and then you see an increase of these kind of activities that I just mentioned in my presentation. So these are something that I think that if you want to pay attention to, you should do that.
About
your
question.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay, just very quickly, to the question of has the U.S. done enough, I think there is a question of what more can the U.S. do, and I think right now we're very much in a window of opportunity. We've seen the Taiwan Travel Act being passed. We've seen a consecutive NDAA language that has very strong provisions in support of Taiwan. And we've seen the opening of a new American Institute in Taiwan facility as well. So, I think these are positive indicators, and they reflect that the U.S. can do more within the framework of the current One China policy as provided for by the Taiwan Relations Act and the Three Assurances and the Six Communiques. So I think that's the question that we should be looking at in the future. On the local elections question, in my view, the local elections are not fought on cross-strait policies or foreign policies necessarily, but I do think success and outcomes in the local election would affect the next presidential election, which then would very much have an effect on the management of cross-strait relations.
Well, let's take another round of questions, and then we'll close out. Yep. Nadia in the front, that's the gentleman on the left. Oh, wow, that's a lot more questions than that. Okay, let's try to get all of this, and then we'll close it. Okay, so, Nadia here.
Actually, the first question is for Roscoe. I would like to know what is Taiwan's version of Indochina people. So far, Taiwan seems to be on the receiving end of the change of U.S. policy. But if Taiwan wants to take initiative, what will be Taiwan's priority? It's not just what U.S. can do, but what Taiwan can do to engage this kind of change.
The left, D.
Thank you. So I have one question for Dr. Kun. So I read your book from 2015 on China military power, and my question is my question is, do you see any surprises after you wrote the book, and also do you see some problems in Chinese military that haven't been dealt with by China in the past 3 years? Thank you.
The the gentleman in the second row and the glasses.
I'm Brody from NYU. I have a question about our coming midterm election, because recently we saw some interesting Taiwanese people's will showing in the two polls conducted by the Taiwan Public Opinion Foundation. The first one is, since the first time the Taiwanese people's favorite impression for the mainland China was 49% is surpassed than the negative feeling with 44% for the first time. And the second polling survey is basically the identified tendency of Taiwanese political parties. The result of distribution was roughly 25% of DPP and 20% of KMT. But the point is, the voter who view themselves as a neutral or independent voters is very higher than before, reach our all-time high of almost 50%. This is a very peculiar moment in Taiwan's political history since we leave the martial law and step into democracy. So the question I wonder is how this post showing would show us to inflate our future midterm election in November, and how they influence our future Austrian relationship, especially there's one more poll still conducted by Taiwan Public Opinion Foundation. Say actually DPP beat the KMT in 7 areas in 10, but the one of the 3 areas the KMT beat DPP is that in ability to deal with the cross-strait relations, which is just 10% Taiwanese people say and believe that DPP has a better ability to handle cross-strait relationship compared to KMT with 57%. It really surprised me. So I wonder what is your assessment on that phenomenon? Is that just short-term phenomenon, or is the tipping point for the long-term situation on cross-strait relationship? You know?
Alright, thank you. And I think we have 2 more questions over here on the right side. Oh, 3 more. Okay, that's it. Okay. Alright. No more.
Okay. Yeah. My question is...
Please state your name and affiliation. Actually, I forgot about that earlier.
I'm just a private citizen.
Okay.
my question is to Ms. Chen regarding the internal disturbances that you mentioned. I heard there's probably up to 50,000 Chinese spies in Taiwan. Can you verify some of this? and the publications from the Communist China and the gang groups, it's very disturbing, but what is the government doing about that?
Great, Mr. on the right side.
Hi everyone, I'm Sean from Radio Creation. I have a question regarding Dr. Bliss just mentioned that there are voices in the U.S. questioning why Taiwan is committed, how Taiwan is committed to defense for themselves. So you think what is lacking here, or how Taiwan could show the international community they're committed to defense for themselves?
Okay, this one right here. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Derek Chen with the U.S. Taiwan Business Council. Someone mentioned earlier about how investment in Taiwan was going down. And as of 2014, Taiwan was actually ranked 16 in openness to foreign investment by the World Economic Forum. And in 2015, that number dropped to 50, and then in 2016 to 87. So just wondering if there was any like specific reason why that was happening, and if China had any hand in that.
Okay. Also, we have a great deal of questions. Pacific. We have a question about the military power report, the rise of independent or neutral voters, spies, and commitment to defense and investment. So just take your pick. You know, you don't have to answer all of them. But you know, please, maybe Katie would just go down the line and see which one you want to address.
I don't think anybody. Well, I think the people who know how many Chinese spies are in Taiwan are probably not here, and they'll probably not tell you. I personally don't know how many Chinese spies, because I did hear
there's at least one of the rest, right?
Well, Well, yeah. I know who you're mentioning. Yeah. There is at least one, but I think the audience really know that there's plenty more. But I cannot confirm there's Chinese, how many Chinese spies are actually in Taiwan. I don't think anybody else could do so. And I think what I could tell you, though, is that I do believe that the Taiwanese government values security very seriously. I think President Tsai also has said things such as cybersecurity is actually part of national security as well. Before when I answer your question about trying to delve into the fundings of these kind of pro-China organizations, and I do believe that the Taiwanese government is also looking into attempts by China and espionage in order to in their attempt to subvert Taiwan's democratic institution.
Okay. So very quickly, first on the investment question, I think there's been, I think I'll say there's been sort of two interesting trends that I've observed when it comes to cross-strait investment. I mean, one is, as Dr. Lai mentioned, there's been diversification of Taiwanese investment away from China into Southeast Asia, and that's perhaps, going with the flow of the new southbound policy, but it's also very much comes down to cost considerations for company, where the cost of production in China is increasing and they might find better alternatives elsewhere in Southeast Asia. But the other one that's, I guess, featuring more prominently is, the investment environment in China. And this is a problem that's faced by not just Taiwanese companies, but many foreign companies, which is being disadvantaged in the market and, of course, IP issues, which is also a big one for not just Taiwanese companies. But we've seen more and more cases of intellectual property being acquired illegally by China. So I think those are two considerations that kind of set the scene for this investment trend. On the polling question, to me the most interesting polls are always on the changing identity, especially the generational shift, because I think that in the long term is really going to drive election results beyond just this midterm. And I think that serves as a good barometer of China's success or lack of success in sort of winning the hearts and minds, even though it's trying to use softer approaches like economic integration and creating more opportunities. I think those are overwhelmed by the political and economic and security pressures.
Regarding the polling, especially the poll you mentioned, that particular poll has, it's not just a poll, but that particularly is an organization conducting the polls, various polls in the past has been questioned because it's not transparent about how they're doing it. Methodology and some interpretation has been questioned by some others. So basically, I just cannot go into that and comment on that poll. But when you talk about the so-called neutral voters, I have to say that when I myself also conduct a poll on behalf of the Taiwan Think Tank in the past, the neutral voters always come the highest when there's no election, and when the national election started to converge, then the people started to fall into the blue-green and the DPP or KMT identifications. So that's a very natural trend. It is not like certain places in U.S. or other where they have a very steadied identification with certain parties. Usually it is until like 2 or 3 months before the elections, whether that's local or national election, that the party identification will start to fall in line. also, it is interesting, it is important to know that the local election itself does not have the direct impact to the cross-strait policy. Of course, it will create a certain expectation from China about how the blue-green or the DPP versus non-DPP political forces. But I think we should be aware of the how some of the outcome in the six major metropolitans elections results, how that will affect the DPP internal politics including the chairmanship of Tsai Ing-wen within the DPP? That will be the key questions.
Regarding Nadia's concern, Taiwan could share our study regarding the political leadership in the inner circle in Beijing and the political development inside mainland China. And also, we could also share the other country in the region or outside the region or Asia Pacific or Indo-Pacific. Our own story, version of very bad memory, including espionage, illegal money going to the hands of the certain people inside Taiwan, that kind of Chinese sharp power, and how Taiwan tackled with that issue. And under the shadow of the Chinese military and political and diplomatic might, how an island like Taiwan can stick to its moral principle and occupy the moral high ground. And Taiwan is on the right side of history, regardless of time it's on which side. And it's difficult to find a consensus among Taiwan, the PRC, and the United States. But I do find one regarding the water in the Taiwan Strait. Dwayne D. Driver mentioned that it's the international water. That is the same version from Taipei. But if you check into the global time, 环球时报, in June and July, twice, not only once, in the editorial or the global time, they also regard the water in the Taiwan Strait is international waterway. It's not necessary for the PRC to raise the issue unless that become a major event from the U.S. So Taiwan can share a lot of its own experiences, the HADR humanitarian assistance disaster relief in the Indo-Pacific region, but we do have our own contribution, even though always overlooked or not emphasized by the other country. But we are there, and dealing with how much or whether or not the U.S. support Taiwan is sufficient or not, it's only one dimension of the security of Taiwan. If we look into the 1992, when President Bush, along in Texas, regarding the huge arms sale, altogether $6 billion, F-16 to Taiwan. But 4 years after that, into the missile crisis in the Taiwan Strait. And in 2001, when George W. Bush announced another huge package of arms sale to Taiwan, and the year follow on, we did witness the growing tension between Taipei and Beijing. So in that sense, I should also refer to the remark I said it earlier. For President Tsai Ing-wen, quad-trade relations and the U.S.-Taiwan relations are equally important for the security of Taiwan.
Just a couple remarks about what surprises I've seen since my book came out in 2015, and of course most of the writing was done by 2014. I would pick upon two things. One is, in the book I had some projections about how rapidly mainland China's forces would modernize in terms of fielding modern tanks and planes and ships and so on. And I would actually say that, and I had projections for, I took the numbers for 2000, 2010, and then I made projections for 2020. And I would say it looks like they are actually moving more slowly than I projected them to in most areas. So that would that I was a little bit too bullish on their part. The other interesting thing to me was has to do with quality of personnel, and I'll try not to get into too much detail on this, but around at the time I was writing the book, the Chinese military was in the process of shifting from a system of training as officers within military academies to trying to draw more and more new officers from China's civilian universities on the basis of the fact that the people in those universities are more independent thinkers and better educated, smarter, and so on. And so the goal at the time was by 2020 that 60% of China's officer corps would have come from civilian universities through a program very similar to the U.S. ROTC program. But what, in fact, what has happened is they shut that program down last year. It may have been 2016 that they shut it down. So they have a few students who are still working their way through the system, but it was declared a failure. And I haven't looked into this in a lot of detail, but I think the issue was integrating these people who were coming from the civilian world into the military culture. And even though these were exactly the type of people they wanted, the independent thinkers, the people who think outside of the box creatively and so on, in theory they wanted those types of people, but in practice those people had trouble adjusting to the very rigid organizational culture of the Chinese military. And so the result of that is probably, you know, they're in the midst of figuring out what they're going to do, but they will not have probably the types of officers that either they wish to have and that in my book I was assuming that they would have within their force by 2020. So both of those things are sort of negative for China in terms of its military modernization. But those would be the two things I would pick out that vary from what I found at the time of the study. The question about what Taiwan can do to convince the world that it is serious about its own defense. So I'm not one of these people that think seriousness is measured by what percentage of your gross domestic product do you spend on national defense. I think that's a poor measure. You can spend lots and lots of money and have a really bad defense establishment. That said, there are some people who are only, you know, they're never going to understand the issue in more depth than that, and they're only going to look at that number, what percentage of GDP is Taiwan spending on defense. But I think, you know, those people are probably a lost cause. You needn't spend any time thinking about how to address them. And so the question is how to convince people who really know what's going on. And I think the way to do that is to be able to present a coherent defense strategy that starts with, you know, a set of objectives, estimates of resources available, and an estimate of what the threat environment is, and works from those general conditions down to a specific set of programs, and so that when you sit down with national security decision makers in the U.S., in the United States, and other countries, you can show them that you do have a coherent program and that you're not just sort of buying this system because it's available today and the chief of staff of the military happens to be from the Air Force and so we're going to buy airplanes now, and then when the chief of staff is from the Navy, we'll buy ships. If you can have a coherent, consistent program that is clearly articulated, and this is where Professor Lin comes in as the head of the new think tank within the Ministry of National Defense. So I think they are in capable hands now that he's taken over there. I think that's the best way to try to convince those skeptics in the U.S. defense establishment.
So, in closing, I just want to thank the Seeger Center for Asian Studies for assisting us in securing this room. And please join me in thanking our wonderful group of panelists.